Hi, this is Jack Shalom. In 2016, Dr. Ibram X. Kendi wrote an acclaimed book called Stamped from the Beginning, the National Book Award-winning history of how racist ideas were created, spread, and deeply rooted in American society. Now that book has been adopted by Dr. Kendi and Jason Reynolds in what they call a remix for young audiences. I'm happy to be talking with Dr. Ibram Kendi and Jason Reynolds. Hi there. And just identify yourselves to the audience. Who's who?
This is Jason Reynolds.
Okay.
And hello, this is Ibram X. Kendi.
Great. Okay, so let's just jump in. Who exactly is the target audience for this book?
I mean, I would say that the target audience is anyone who is breathing. Obviously, you know, when it was, look, it's marketed toward young people, but it doesn't mean that it's solely for young people. I think young people need to be able to read it and then engage in discourse with adults and community leaders and church leaders and coaches. And why limit it? Everybody needs to have a conversation about this because it affects all of our lives.
Now, the basic framework you lay out in terms of categories of thinking about race are racists, assimilationists, and anti-racists. Can you explain what you mean by each category a little more?
So we put forth two different types of categories for racists, and that's segregationist and assimilationist. And segregationists, as we call them in the book, are more like haters. These are people who imagine, let's say, black people are fundamentally different and fundamentally inferior. And then you have assimilationists who believe that black people are fundamentally, we're all created equal, but black people became inferior on earth, and so black people are more environmentally inferior or inferior by nurture, and so it's their job to civilize and develop black people. And then anti-racists basically believe that not only are the races essentially or biologically equal, but that even their different cultures and the way they look, despite those differences, they're on the same level. They're equals.
You call this a non-history book so that you don't scare any young people away, I guess. As a former high school teacher, I totally understand that approach. But you do take on events and people in chronological order. So let's start at the beginning. In the book, some may be surprised to hear that you identify a person who you call the world's first racist. So who is he and what makes you identify him that way?
In the mid-1400s, the Portuguese really pioneered the transatlantic slave trade, kidnapped people, enslaved them, and brought them back to Portugal. And eventually, Portuguese slave traders would be bringing them over to the so-called New World. But then they also justified their slave trading in African people by classifying these many different looking people, these many different ethnic groups, as one people, as one inferior people, as one inferior black people. And Gomez Zarara, who essentially wrote a biography of Prince Henry and his slave trading, really was the first to essentially make that case in which he racialized black people and then dubbed them inferior to justify the racist policies of Prince Henry and Portuguese slave traders.
You also talk about how racism was embedded and spread in the Americas with the coming of the Puritans, who depended on the cultivation of tobacco. How did that work, and how did the formation of racist educational institutions come forth from that?
From Dr. Kendi's research, you know, what I learned is that when the Puritans came over, they came over with an Aristotelian sort of backing in terms of intellectually thinking about what it meant to have a human hierarchy. Of course, Aristotle believed that the Greeks were superior, but when the Puritans came over, they pretty much sort of transmuted that into the Puritans were superior, right? And then those same sort of Puritans and their Puritan partners then start America's first institution of higher education, which we all know is Harvard University, and written into the bylaws of Harvard University, written into the cornerstone of that cultural educational institution, was that Greek literature couldn't be argued, which meant that Aristotle couldn't be argued, which meant that human hierarchy, in essence, couldn't be argued. So from the very onset, the church and the school were built on racist ideas.
I learned a lot from this book. I was happy to see your inclusion of Bacon's Rebellion in the early history of America, because it was really the combination of so many telling contradictory race and class factors. Could you speak about that Bacon's Rebellion?
So sure. I mean, you know, Bacon's Rebellion, which happened in the 1670s, in which you had this white planter named Bacon, and he, being more on the sort of frontier, he had to battle against Native American people who these settlers were pushing up, of course, constantly and taking over their land. And so basically to get back at the central sort of political figures who he felt were not helping him fight off these Native American communities near him, he, in a sense, revolted against centralized Virginia leadership, against the Virginia governor. And in order to create that revolt, he not only armed working class, non-slaveholding or non-landholding whites, indentured servants on the frontier, but also enslaved Africans and freed them and marched on the sort of capital, in our sense, of Virginia. And Virginia leaders, of course, saw this sort of combination of white indentured servants and enslaved Black Africans being led by Bacon as their Armageddon. They realized that there was no way they could maintain their power, maintain not only white servitude but Black slavery, if these two groups of laborers were allying together. And so as a result, they were eventually able to put down the rebellion, but they also made sure to put down that interracial labor organizing by essentially privileging or providing privileges to those white workers and denying them to the Black workers.
And that's the thing that keeps coming up in the book, the splitting of Black and white unions in order to dilute their power. You do highlight sort of positively in your book that there are people who took the journey from assimilationism to anti-racism, and you say that happened with Martin Luther King and with Du Bois. Could you talk a bit more about that, and what made people move from one position to the other?
Well, I mean, you give the example of W.E.B. Du Bois, who went on to Fisk University and Harvard, and these were places where at the time he was constantly sort of taught that, you know, Black people were indeed inferior because that inferiority was due to their remnants of slavery, but they can sort of progress out of their brutishness. And you, Du Bois, you're a reflection of the possibilities of Black people, and you thereby need to sort of train and show white America what is possible. And by 1930s, he wrote an essay, this is essentially 40 years later, that he's tried to show white America through word, through deed, through periodical, through books, through every which way, the humanity of Black folk, but they have refused to listen. And so maybe that strategy is the problem, and maybe indeed there is not a problem with what he called the bottom 90th. Maybe I should not be assessing Black people from European cultural standards. And so he transformed himself by the 1930s. And ultimately, instead of saying that the problem was racism and Black people, he started focusing first and foremost on racism.
And you say that transformation can be reflected in later movements such as the Black Panthers and women like Angela Davis. Would you like to talk more about them, how they advanced the cause of anti-racism?
Many of the leaders of the Black Power movement, particularly the initial leaders, a lot of those people came out of the civil rights movement. And they recognized that they gained rights, civil and voting rights, but they didn't necessarily gain dignity. They didn't necessarily eliminate racial inequity. And so they recognized what they gained and what they did not gain, and then built a movement based on what they had not gained. And, of course, Angela Davis was one of the principal figures of the Black Power movement. But then she also, to her credit, also not only recognized that Black people as a group needed to be defended, she also recognized that Black women in particular had been degraded within and outside of the Black community, that Black poor people, that incarcerated Black people had been degraded inside and outside of certainly the black community, that black single mothers were being castigated in the 1980s. And so she went on to defend many of these groups of black people who everyone seems to be blaming for the problem as opposed to recognizing the racist policies that were ensnaring them.
Every time anti-racists made some progress, racists would kick back, you say, and not only with repressive laws and repressive law enforcement, but also culturally. Can you talk about the meanings of the films Tarzan, Planet of the Apes, and Rocky?
Yeah, I think, you know, media has always been a propagandizing force against black people. I mean, I would argue we're still fighting that fight in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. But you take a film like Planet of the Apes, and you look at it sort of in context of when it came out, and there's this idea that there's this planet where the apes are sort of taking over the planet, and they're killing the folks, and then all of a sudden at the end of the movie you realize, oh no, this planet isn't overrun with apes. It's our planet. It's Earth. You know. I think.
And what was that a direct response to?
Well, that film came out in the late 1960s. And so if we remember in the late 1960s, that was when there was a global black power movement from Africa to Brooklyn and Los Angeles, in which black people were not only demanding power, but taking power politically. This was the tail end of the decolonization of Africa, the decolonization of Latin America and Asia. And so all over the world, people of color were taking control of their communities. And you had many white people seeing that as them taking over white people, as taking over the earth. And so that's how a movie like Planet of the Apes, where apes take over in 1968, in 1969, can hold so much relevance to so many white people.
Hmm. And what kind of response have you been getting from young people about the book?
Oh, it's been amazing. Ultimately, it's been a situation where young people feel like, first and foremost, they feel angry that not just because of the content in the book, but because they feel like this information has been kept from them. They feel like they want to know why their schools haven't been teaching them this, why their parents haven't been telling them this. I mean, they want to know the information. They want to be armed and equipped to have these conversations because they desperately want to change culture and move the line forward.
Well, you've done a great job of adapting it and making the book entertaining and accessible to young people. And you're not shy about saying your opinion. There's lots of first-person opinion in there, which kind of points the way as to where the book is going. So I think it's really great that way. I'm going to push a little bit here because we have a pretty politically sophisticated audience here at BAI Pacifica. So I'm going to ask, is it possible to be a capitalist and an anti-racist?
Well, I mean, I think that whether you're talking about the most conservative or the most Marxist historians of capitalism, they both root its origins in Western Europe in the long, what's called 15th century, from the mid-1400s to the mid-1600s. It just so happened that racism emerged at the same time in the same place. It spread across the globe. You can't really separate the rise and spread of capitalism from the transatlantic slave trade, from colonialism, from slavery. It's impossible. Nor can you separate currently in this country and around the world wealth from whiteness and poverty from blackness. And so for me, what I see both historically and empirically is this interrelationship between racism and capitalism historically and currently. And so to essentially say you are a capitalist is, I argue, to essentially say you're a racist without maybe even knowing it. And to truly be anti-racist, I would argue you truly have to be anti-capitalist in the way I understand it and define it.
And I'm going to push you guys a little bit further, okay? Do you think it's fruitful for anti-racists to work within the Democratic Party?
The Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, like any sort of political party, is based on who essentially is in the party. And so there's nothing essential about the Democratic Party. The people and the leaders of the Democratic Party, the voters of the Democratic Party, make the party, not the other way around. And so for me, I certainly think that anti-racists should be seeking to transform every political party, every institution, every site and place where policy is made, you know, in a more anti-racist light.
Hmm. Any last words from either one of you?
For me, just that I work for and around and with children. So for me, all I want to add is, if you love children, first of all, if you care about the future of our nation, you have to care about the future of our children. And if you care about the future of our children, then anti-racism is the only way to do so.
Yeah, and I'll just echo that.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Jason and Ibram. I've been talking with Jason Reynolds and Dr. Ibram Kendi, authors of Stamped, a remix for young audiences of the National Book Award-winning Stamped from the Beginning. Stamped is published by Little Brown & Company. This is Jack Shalom for Arts Express with host Prairie Miller.